This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Divorces are ugly. Even the most amicable ones are a mess of paperwork, lawyer bills, and awkward holiday negotiations. But Dan Markell and Wendy Adelson's divorce? That wasn't just ugly. It allegedly was a full-blown war. Dan Markell was a Harvard-educated law professor, a legal scholar with a razor-sharp mind and a reputation for being uncompromising. He wasn't the kind of guy to let things slide. Wendy, on the other hand, allegedly was a rising academic in her own right, an attorney, and a writer, by all accounts. When they first met, they seemed like a perfect match, two brilliant legal minds. But as it turns out, two lawyers under one roof can be a dangerous combination in some cases. And by 2012, after 6 years of marriage and two young children, Wendy filed for divorce. Not just any divorce. This was the kind where every detail was a battlefield. Custody, property, money, control. But the biggest fight? Wendy wanted out of Tallahassee. She wanted to move back to South Florida, allegedly, where her family lived, where she would have financial support, childcare, and the life that she wanted. Dan, though, wasn't having it. He loved the kids, and he wasn't about to let them be taken 400 miles away. He fought Wendy's relocation request in court, and he won. A judge ruled that Wendy had to stay in Tallahassee with the children as long as Dan lived there. That ruling changed everything because for the Adelson family, Tallahassee wasn't just inconvenient, it was unacceptable. Wendy's family, her mother Donna, her father Harvey, and especially her brother Charlie, were not passive bystanders in this divorce. They were deeply involved in ways that most families, healthy families, wouldn't be or just shouldn't be. Donna Adelson, Wendy's mother, despised Dan Markell allegedly. She saw him as controlling, arrogant, and worst of all, an obstacle. She allegedly just didn't want her daughter and grandkids out of Tallahassee. She needed them out. She offered Markell money to let Wendy relocate. $1 million is what she offered. No, not just, hey, let me get you the U-Haul, $1 million. He refused, allegedly, because for Dan, this wasn't about money. It was about his kids. And to most people, that would be the end of it. The court had ruled, Markell had spoken, and Wendy had no choice but to stay. That's what happens a lot of times in divorce situations. But the Adelsons, they weren't the type to take no for an answer. This was a family that had resources, connections, and a lot of money. Suddenly, they had a problem that no amount of legal maneuvering seemed to solve. It was around this time, October of 2013, that Charlie Adelson did something interesting. Wendy had been actively looking for a new home in Tallahassee, trying to settle into her post-divorce life. But suddenly, on October 31st, Charlie told her to stop. He told her not to buy a house in Tallahassee, allegedly. Now, at the time, that might seem like just another overbearing sibling trying to control things. Don't do this. I know better. You know, that all, that stuff. But here's where it gets chilling. Because on October 31st, 2013, it's also the exact day that Charlie Adelson first inquired about hiring a hitman. So what does that mean? It means that before Wendy could even think about putting down roots in Tallahassee, before she could accept her new reality, Charlie was already exploring an alternative, allegedly. And Wendy, she either had no idea what was happening behind the scenes, or she did. It's one or the other. And the months leading up to the murder, things continued to escalate. In June of 2014, about a month before Markell was murdered, Wendy had a conversation with her then boyfriend, Jeffrey Lacoste, that in hindsight sounds deeply ominous. According to Lacoste, Wendy was frustrated. She felt trapped in Tallahassee. And then she told him something that stuck with him long after Markel was dead. She said that her brother, Charlie, was considering options to solve her problem. Now, that's an interesting choice of words, isn't it? Not helping me find a legal solution, not supporting me while I figure this out, but considering options. Then when Lacoste asked what she meant, Wendy allegedly told him that Charlie had looked into hiring a hitman. Now, Lacoste didn't think much of it at the time. People say a lot of things and moments of anger and frustration, but after the murder, he remembered that conversation very differently. Because just weeks later, Dan Markel would be dead. That brings us to July 18th of 2014, the morning of the murder. We know what happened that day. We know that Markel dropped his kids off at daycare. We know he went to the gym. We know he pulled into his driveway around 11 a.m. Two hitmen hired by people connected to Wendy's family were waiting for him. We also know that minutes after the murder, Charlie Adelson and his mother, Donna, were on the phone with each other. But what about Wendy? Well, just 40 minutes after Dan was shot, Wendy did do something curious. She called Dan's phone. Now, on the surface, that might seem normal. Maybe she was just calling him about the kids. Maybe she didn't know yet, or maybe, just maybe, she was checking to see if the plan had worked. Who knows? This is where things start to take shape. The motive is clear. Wendy wanted out of Tallahassee. Her family was desperate to make that happen. And just weeks before Markel was killed, Wendy said out loud that Charlie was looking into solutions. Now, maybe Wendy was just venting. Maybe she really thought her brother was joking when he said a hitman was cheaper than a TV. And maybe he was joking at that moment in time. But then maybe started thinking more about it later. Or maybe she knew what was coming. Nobody really knows right now, except for her. She's never been charged with anything as of now. And she is innocent of anything. She's never been charged with anything. And she's denied having any knowledge of these events going on. So, it's a lot of allegedly in this as we get closer and closer to mom's trial date. Here's something else that got really curious. The day after Markel was murdered, Wendy finally got what she wanted. She packed up her kids, moved to South Florida, and never looked back. Like, boom. But was Wendy just an innocent beneficiary of this crime? Or is there something more? We know what happened next. We also know about the cover-up, the FBI sting, and the suspicious financial transactions that would eventually lead to arrests. And we know that Wendy somehow still has not been charged. So maybe she really does not know anything. It was quick. It was two shots, one to the head, another to the face, fired at close range when Dan Markel sat defenseless in his car. At exactly 11 a.m. on July 18th of 2014, the assassination of Dan Markel was carried out with chilling efficiency. The killer, Sigfrido Garcia and Luis Riviera, had trailed Markel all morning. They had watched him drop off his kids at daycare, followed him to the gym, and then waited as he made his way home. When he pulled into his driveway, the silver Toyota Prius they were driving blocked him in. Rivera stayed in the driver's seat. Garcia got out, walked up to Markell's car window, and pulled the trigger. A murder for hire, precise and brutal. By 11:06 a.m., Donna Adelson, Wendy's mother, was making a phone call to Charlie Adelson. This is where the web starts to unravel, because what happens next is not the behavior of an innocent family member learning about an unexpected tragedy. It's the behavior of people who maybe knew what was coming. Maybe. Charlie didn't answer his mother's call at 11:06, but at 11:22 a.m., just minutes after Markell had been shot, Charlie called Donna back. They spoke for 7 minutes. At 11:42 a.m., Wendy called Dan Markell's phone. Now, this is where you have to ask yourself, okay, why? Dan and Wendy were divorced. They weren't in the habit of casually checking in with each other. By this time in the day, Dan should have been back home alone, but instead his phone was ringing while he lay dying in his car just outside his house. It's a lot of questions that arise at that moment. There are only a few explanations. One is that Wendy was simply calling about something routine. It happens. Maybe about the kids, maybe to ask about pickup times or travel plans, you know, normal stuff. Or maybe she was checking to see if he'd answer. Because if he didn't, let me point to something. Meanwhile, something else was happening. A dark-colored Honda Odyssey minivan, a car that looked suspiciously like Wendy's, was seen approaching the crime scene just as police were beginning to block off the road. The driver stopped, saw the commotion, then turned around and left. Coincidence? Possibly. Or possibly not. By early afternoon, Tallahassee police were already knocking on Wendy Adelson's door. A high-profile law professor had just been shot in a quiet neighborhood. The first place you start a case like this is the spouse, especially when that spouse is locked in a bitter, ongoing legal battle with the victim. Wendy met them at her house and agreed to go down to the station for questioning. And this is where things get strange. Most people, when they sit down with police after learning their ex has been murdered, they're in shock. They're confused. They have no idea what to think. They wait for the police to tell them what happened. Wendy? The moment she sat down, she floated the idea that her own family might be involved. No one had asked about her family. No one had suggested that anyone in her life had anything to do with this. And yet there she was, talking about it. And then came the part that would follow her for years, the moment when she casually mentioned that her brother Charlie had joked about hiring a hitman to solve her divorce problems. Yeah. Let's pause for a second. Imagine you're a detective sitting across from a woman who just found out that her ex-husband was assassinated in his driveway. You're not even an hour into the interview, and she's already talking about a murder-for-hire joke her brother made that very morning. That's not normal. That's not anywhere close to normal. But Wendy did seem to realize how it sounded. She downplayed it, as if it was just dark humor, just something Charlie would say. But here's the thing. People who aren't involved in murders don't usually bring up murder-for-hire jokes within hours of the crime. So was Wendy getting ahead of the story? Was she trying to explain away something she knew might come up later? Or was this just an incredibly unlucky coincidence? Maybe, you know, sometimes you do have inclinations about what you fear people may do. And maybe that fear is what became a reality, and she was just trying to learn to accept it without looking as if she was truly involved. Just had a fear that maybe Charlie and Mom might cook something up. but they never went to her about it. Could that be the case too? By the time the sun set that evening, Dan Markell was dead. His ex-wife had been questioned and released, and now the Adelson family was moving fast. The very next day, when he packed up her two sons and left Tallahassee for South Florida, never moved back. But again, you got to think of it. You just have this trauma happen in your life, and you have two kids that now have to understand that you're never going to see Dad again. And if you have nothing to do with this, you probably want to go to family. Assuming you don't know that your family did this. Or it could work the other way if you did know. The optics, either way, aren't great, but they make sense. Dan Markell had fought tooth and nail to keep his children from being taken away from him. He'd won that battle in court, but now he was gone. Just like that, the custody battle was over. The next few months were full of quiet, calculated decisions. Wendy cut off all contact with Dan Markell's parents. She changed her children's last names from Markell to Adelson. She quit her job at Florida State University and never returned to teaching. One fell swoop, she had completely severed her old life, and then there were the finances. While Wendy's hands never directly touched the money that paid for the hit, the cash started flowing. Charlie Adelson, the alleged mastermind, funneled tens of thousands of dollars to Catherine McBona, the woman who connected him to the hitman. A used Lexus, a job at the Adelson family dental practice where she didn't actually work. Big chunks of cash handed over in a way that suggested this wasn't just about romance. It was about hush money. Meanwhile, a phone record showed that the Adelsons were still talking constantly. Wendy, Charlie, Donna. Charlie was calling McBona. McBona was calling the hitmen. And yet, through all of this, Wendy never seemed to directly touch the crime. She never sent the texts, never made the calls. She never moved the money. So the question is, was that by design? Was she deliberately kept out of the paper trail? Or was she truly just an unlucky bystander in a crime that happened to make her life a whole lot easier? Is it a combination of it all? 2 years passed before the first arrests were made. In 2016, the killers were finally taken into custody, Sigfrido Garcia and Luis Riviera. The case was breaking wide open. The same year, the FBI decided to test the Adelsons. They sent an undercover agent to approach Donna Adelson, pretending to be someone who knew about the murder. He handed her a note demanding cash. This was the moment. If Donna was innocent, she would have gone straight to the police. Instead, she called Charlie. Charlie then immediately called Catherine McBona. And the next time Charlie and Donna were in a room together, they were caught on tape discussing the situation in ways that suggested they weren't just innocent bystanders. But through all of this, Wendy remained untouched. She wasn't in the wiretap. She wasn't in the money transfer. She wasn't in the recorded conversations. Which leaves us with two possibilities. Again, either she truly didn't know what was happening behind the scenes, which is where it appears to stand now. As like I said, no charges have ever been brought against her. And I actually seriously wonder if this was all done without her having knowledge, but just kind of having that inkling like, oh shit, I know my family and they will get what they want. But also, I don't know. I don't know. Or she knew enough to stay out of it. That's a question that has haunted this case for years. Was Wendy just a lucky recipient of her family's crimes? Oh, oops, all this happened. Gee, I'm glad your life is going to be much easier now, and you're going to be here because we want the kids down here. Or was there something more? As one thing is for sure, while the rest of the Adelsons were scrambling trying to cover their tracks, Wendy just walked away. Walking away doesn't mean you get away with it. And as we're about to see, the walls around the Adelson family were starting to close in. If this case were playing out in a movie, Wendy Adelson would have been arrested long ago. The bitter divorce, the custody battle, the suspicious comments, and the fact that the hit gave her exactly what she wanted. It all adds up to a story that feels obvious. But this isn't a movie. It's a real world where prosecutors don't just need a story, they need evidence. And that's why, despite everything, Wendy Adelson is still free. Because when it comes to proving a murder conspiracy in court, suspicion isn't enough. You need a smoking gun. And so far, no one has found one. Doesn't mean the case against Wendy isn't compelling. It is. The timeline alone raises serious questions. The hitman joke, the phone call to Dan Markell just minutes after the shooting, the immediate relocation, the name change, the severing of ties with Dan's family. It all paints a picture of someone who, at best, I don't know, is acting kind of suspicious. But did she know more than she admitted? Legally, that's just not enough. Unlike Charlie and Donna, Wendy was never caught on wiretap discussing the crime. She wasn't part of the FBI's undercover sting. There's no recorded conversation where she talks about money being moved or making sure someone is kept quiet. Her name never appears in any payments. She never called the hitman. She never texted anyone about the plot. And that creates a problem for prosecutors if they're looking at her. And believe me, they've looked. Because in a case like this, you don't just need circumstantial evidence. You need to prove intent. You need to prove that Wendy knew the murder was going to happen, agreed to it, or actively participated in the planning. And right now, they can't prove it. And like I said, they've looked. Anything you could look at that exists has been examined. Part of the reason Wendy remains untouched is because of a calculated move by the prosecution. They also gave her immunity. Now, let's be clear on this. This wasn't a get-out-of-jail-free card. It was use immunity, which means that nothing she said on the witness stand can be used against her. It does not mean that she can never be charged. It just means that if prosecutors wanted to indict her, they have to do it with things that were not within her own words. They can't use her own words against her from whatever she testified to at that time. And that complicates things because Wendy testified at multiple trials. She was questioned about the hitman joke, about her family's disdain for Markell, about the way she immediately relocated after his death. She was pressed about why she told police her own family might be involved and why she casually dropped that hitman line into the conversation. And she stuck to her story. She did not crack. She did not slip up. She never admitted to knowing anything. And since her words were protected by immunity, prosecutors have to build a case without them if they ever want to go after her. But is there anything to go after her with? Should they even have to go after her? Is this all exactly what she claims it is? An overzealous family that went out and did her bidding without her even asking them to do so. What else do they have? If Wendy's ever going to be charged, it will likely come down to one thing, a co-conspirator flipping. Because right now, the only people who truly know whether Wendy was involved are the people who planned the murder. Charlie. Allegedly Donna, maybe even Harvey, if anything happens there. But he's never been charged with anything either. So far, there's no evidence that points to Harvey or Wendy knowing anything about this. It's a hard one to swallow, though, isn't it? Charlie, even after being convicted, hasn't implicated Wendy. Donna, even after being arrested, hasn't said a word. And if no one talks, prosecutors may never get the piece of evidence they need to move forward. But again, you don't need it if it doesn't exist. But here's where things get interesting. With Donna's trial coming up, the stakes for her could not be higher. She's in her 70s. She's facing life in prison. And if she sees no way out, will she start talking? If she does, and if she implicates Wendy, then all bets are off. Because the moment one of the co-conspirators confirms that Wendy knew all about the hit before it happened, that's the moment prosecutors could finally move, if that, in theory, ever happens. If it's even possible, if it's even true. Because right now it's an allegation. And that might be exactly what they're waiting for. While the prosecution waits, the public has already made up its mind. Because in the court of public opinion, many think Wendy Adelson had something to do with this. Maybe not pulling the trigger, maybe not hiring the hitman herself. But allegations that she might have knew something. Guilty of benefiting. Guilty of walking away from a murder that gave her exactly what she wanted. And that perception does matter, even if it's flawed, even if it's not true. Because every time someone else in the case gets convicted, first the hitman, then McBonna, then Charlie, it adds more pressure for Wendy to maybe be next. Or does it end now with Donna? But the pressure can only go so far, because if the state charges her and loses, that's it. They don't get a do-over. They don't get to try again. Double jeopardy would apply, and Wendy Adelson would be untouchable, which means prosecutors have to be sure. They can't afford a weak case. They can't afford a miss. So where does this leave us? Right now, Wendy is free. She's still in South Florida, still raising her kids, still living a life untouched by the legal consequences that have swallowed many other members of her family. That doesn't mean that she's not safe from ever being prosecuted, because this case is far from over. And with Donna's trial on the horizon, with every piece of evidence that comes out, with every new conviction, the walls are closing in. If prosecutors get what they need, if somebody does talk and implicates her, then Wendy Adelson's day in court might still be coming. If that day comes, she won't have the luxury of walking away this time. What do you think? Tell us in the comments section. If you're watching us on YouTube, if you're listening to the podcast, check us out on YouTube, and you can watch all of our podcasts as we do them, and comment as well. Lots of great folks in there discussing these cases right now. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you are downloading podcasts. You don't miss any of the stories that we continue to cover for you right here at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for watching.
The world of true crime never stops, and neither do we. Press subscribe now to get daily updates, in-depth analysis, and expert opinions from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. She was the perfect wife, always smiling, always supportive. A pillar of the community, beloved by friends, adored by family, and secretly researching undetectable poisons in her spare time. Maybe it was the way he chewed. Maybe she just got bored. Or maybe, just maybe, she had been planning this since the honeymoon. But if he had just paid attention, if he had just known what to look for, if he had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and learned the red flags, he could have heard every episode of Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Ad-free, and before everyone else, he could have seen it coming. Instead, he's 6 feet under, and she's shopping for husband number two. Don't be like him. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.